Yeah, we're doing Bishalach. That's after the Jews left Mitzrayim. So, in Perek Yadalad, it says that God spoke to Moshe to speak to the Bnei Yisrael, the Yoshuvu, turn back from the position that they were in, and to camp before a mountain pass called Pi Hachiros, which was opposite Baal Tzephon. That was one of the idols that the Egyptians worshipped. And it was close to the sea, to the Red Sea, Al Hayam. And the purpose of this was to ensnare Paro. So God was commanding Moshe to tell the Jews to actually put themselves in a dangerous position, to go back towards a position which would make them vulnerable to the attack of Paro, and to create the impression that they were lost. And Paro will say that they're confused, Nevuchim heim ba'aretz, they're perplexed, they're confused, Sagar aleihem hamidbar, that they're sort of locked into the midbar. Basically, sometimes a person gets lost sometimes in like a maze, and everywhere you turn, you're confused. You can't get out of the situation, and you keep turning. Sometimes a person could be, on a hike in a mountain, and he's looking for the trail and tries different approaches and realizes that he's completely lost and he's lost his bearings. That's the sense of Sagar aleihem hamidbar, that they've lost their bearings and they just can't move. Then it says V'chizakti eslev paro, that God will harden his heart, V'radaf achareihem, and he'll chase after them. And God is saying that he'll be glorified through Paro. What is and all of his army, and the Yadu Mitzrayim Kineir Hashem, and Mitzrayim will know that I am God. What does that mean, that I'll be glorified through Paro? Rashi comments on that. Kishakadosh Baruch Hu Misnakim Bershayim, when God avenges the wicked, Shemo Misgadel Umiskabed, his name is magnified and glorified. And he quotes the source in Yecheskel, Viskadalti Viskadashti Vinodati. And that's in conjunction with the idea that God destroys the wicked. Which means to say that it's not just a means by which God is made known, because there could be many avenues by which God's existence could be made known, but this has a special significance, because the way the person is constructed, there's an element of denial. Each person has a certain element of denial. And there is a tendency in mankind to deny God when the wicked are in command, when those who deny God, basically like Amalek, when they take over and they have control. So this has the effect, so people deny that there's anything outside of the physical, anything outside of the physical universe, because they say that the only thing that matters is the physical might. They run the world, and there's really no justice in the world. That's the whole idea of Amalek. So when God destroys the Rishayim, it teaches mankind a lesson, not only that the existence of God, but that the purpose of God in this world, that God relates to this world, and the objective of God's relationship to the world is that people should live in a certain kind of a way, in a manner of justice. So this is always a challenge. People always question that. Is there any justice in the world? Is it just random? Is there any significance? And so on and so forth. So as long as there's the triumph of Rishayim, so that reinforces the feeling in people that that's all that matters. It's just might makes right. It's just a mechanistic situation. So that's the meaning over here, V'kavda b'paro, that there's a special Kiddush Hashem that comes into being with the destruction of the Rishayim. So basically, that's why the Jews were commanded to go back. But bear in mind that in doing so, this would put them in a vulnerable position. So the Pasuk then says, V'yasu chein, that the Jews complied. They complied with this. Now, why does it have to tell us that they complied with this? So Rashi says, Lahagit Shifchan, This is to speak their praises. This was praiseworthy. Sheshamu l'kol Moshe, that they listened to the voice of Moshe. V'lo amru, and they didn't say, Heich niskariv el rodfenu. How can we draw closer to our pursuers? Anu tzrichim livroach. We have to run away. Ela amru, but they said, Ein lanu ela divrei ben Amram. All we have to go by are the words of ben Amram, that is to say, the words of Moshe. According to Rashi, this is describing the praise of the Jews. It would seem that they had reached a high level. That is to say that from an emotional standpoint, if you put yourself in that situation, the natural emotion is to go the other direction. Of course, part of the whole idea of Yahadus in terms of human perfection is that a person just doesn't operate in accordance with his natural emotion. Because the natural emotion that a person feels in virtually every situation, very rarely is it in line with the object of truth. Yeah, so one of the challenges is for a person to recognize that and to be able to put it aside and to utilize a different element of the psyche to analyze it from the standpoint of knowledge and objectivity. So apparently in this situation, where the emotions are very, very powerful, and they would have dictated that a person should keep running, and certainly not to go back towards the line of fire, they did so, because they were on a high level, and they recognized that they had to operate in accordance with the truth, and the Moshe Rabbeinu was the Navi Hashem. And even though what he was saying went contrary to their emotions, that's what they should do. So this is praiseworthy. Now, in light of that, let's see what happens after that. Then you have, then it says that it was told to Paro that Kibarach Ha'am, that the nation had ran away. That's interesting in its own right. It sounds strange. What do you mean it was told to him that they had ran away? He was the one that came and gave the order. I mean, according to Rashi, it was personally. He came after Moshe and Aaron. Whether it's literally true that he ran personally after them, which is not difficult to accept, given the terror of Makas Bechoros. But clearly it was with his knowledge, with his order, that the Jews had left. So on the surface, the pasuk seems strange that it was told to him, and then suddenly he doesn't know. And somebody had to report to him that the Jews had escaped. So what's the meaning of that pasuk? You have to deduce that up to this point, Paro thought that the Jews were simply leaving, according to the original demand of Moshe, to journey for 3 days in the wilderness and then to worship God, and that they were going to return. If you take a look at Rashi makes this point. Ikturin Shalachimahem says that the Paro sent a spy along with them. And once 3 days arrived that they had established that they would worship in return, and he saw that they weren't returning to Mitzrayim, so he came and he told Paro on the fourth day. Then Rashi says on the fifth and on the sixth he chased after them, and on the night of the seventh they were drowned in the sea, in Bishachvas Amrushira. And in the morning, Rashi gives an account, a step-by-step account, of the 7 days that they, from the time they left until the Egyptians were drowned in the Yamsuf. And that was the Shvi Shel Pesach. That was the seventh day of Pesach. And that's the reason why we have the minhag to read the Shira on the seventh day of Pesach. But all the Mefarshim say the same idea. For example, the Ibn Ezra. Vayugad, it was told, ki ein holchim ki im levroach. It was told to him that they're not leaving except to run away. The Sforno says the same thing. That Paro was told that they were not going in a straight path, as they had implied. They're just going to go a distance. That all they needed was a space to separate themselves from Egypt of 3 days. And they weren't going in that kind of a straight path, but they were going in a circuitous path in the custom of those who are seeking to escape. So at this point in time, apparently, Paro expected that they would return. Then it says that the Paro vayehapech levav Paro vavadav elam, and Paro and his servants had a change of heart regarding the people, and they said, "Mazos asinu, what have we done? Kishilachnu as Yisrael me'avdenu, that we sent the Jews away from serving us." I just want to take note of a question which is occurring to me. It seems to me, at least superficially, that there's a little bit of a problem in the pasuk over here, because if indeed we're saying that Paro expected them to return, and then he found out that they were escaping, so then why would it be vayehapech levav Paro? What was the change of heart? There was no change of heart involved. There was new information. And what does it mean? And they said, "Mazos asinu." Then I'm not sure. Perhaps that could be understood as now it was a realization that they had been tricked, and that it wasn't just to serve God that they had left, but that they were freeing themselves from the enslavement. So that I understand. But the changing of the heart, I'm not quite sure what the pshat is at this point. Then it says that he prepared the chariots and he took his nation. Then it describes all of the choice chariots and all of the Rechav Mitzrayim, a massive army and officers. So he gathered together pretty much the entire nation. Then it says that God hardened his heart. Vayechazek Hashem eslev Paro melech Mitzrayim. God hardened his heart. And he chased after the Bnei Yisrael. And here it says, the Bnei Yisrael yotzim biyad rama. That the Bnei Yisrael had gone out with a high hand. It's interesting to note over here, what is the connection of the fact that they had gone out biyad rama? The Ebenezer points out, lo yotzu kidmus borchim. They had not left like people who are trying to run away, to escape. V'hoi imam kol klei hamulchama. They had with them all the weapons of war. Let's continue the description. So it says that the Mitzrayim chased after them, and they caught them encamping by the Yam, by the sea. Mentions again all of the horses, the chariots, the army of Paro, by Piachiros Lefne Baal Tzafon. Then it says, Paro Hikriv, and Paro drew close. Vayisu Bnei Yisrael Asay Nehem, and the Bnei Yisrael lifted their eyes. Vihine Mitzrayim Nosea Acharehem, and behold, the Egyptians were traveling after them. Vayiru ma'od, and they were greatly afraid. Vayitaku b'nei Yisrael el al Hashem, and the b'nei Yisrael cried out to God. Vayomer el Moshe, and they said to Moshe, Hamibli ein kvarim b'Mitzrayim, are there not any graves in Mitzrayim? L'kachtonu lomos b'midbar, that you took us to die in the midbar, in the wilderness. Mazos asis alanu, what is this that you've done to us? Lahotzianu mimitzrayim, to take us out of Egypt. Halozeh adavar asher dibarnu eilecha b'mitzrayim lemor, is this not what we said to you in Egypt? Chadal mimenu v'navdas mitzrayim, leave us alone, and we'll serve the Egyptians. That is where we're okay. We're satisfied. We prefer it. Kitov lanu avodas Mitzrayim, because it's better for us to serve Mitzrayim mimusenu b'midbar, as opposed to dying in the wilderness. Now, before we go to the answer of Moshe Rabbeinu, let's pause and ask some questions here. The question is, what took place? What happened to the Jews? That they were complaining. Rebelling, actually, against Moshe. We just read that Vayasuchein, the Shevach of the Jews, the praise, that in spite of the fact that it was contrary to their emotions, in spite of the fact that it was dangerous, they listened to Moshe Rabbeinu. They accepted the fact that he was the Navi, and they based themselves on what he told them to do. So they voluntarily put themselves into the line of fire. So what happened now? Once they saw the Mitzrayim coming after them. There's an interesting Rashi on Nosei Achareim. So Rashi says, that is to say, traveling after them, pursuing them. So Rashi says, Belev Echad, with one heart, Ki Ish Echad, as one person. Davar Acher, another interpretation. V'hinei Mitzrayim Nosei Achareim. And behold, Egypt was pursuing them. Ra'u Sar Shel Mitzrayim. They saw the master of Mitzrayim, Noseya min Hashamayim, traveling forth from the heaven, Lazar le Mitzrayim, to help Mitzrayim. Of course, the question is, what does that mean? How are we to understand something like that? What's the concept over here? Are we talking about a literal, that they actually saw something flying from the sky? And how are we to understand that? And if indeed that's the case, which is very difficult to take it that way, if they actually saw something coming down from heaven to help the Egyptians, so then you can't blame them for any kind of reaction. But it's virtually impossible to understand it that way. What's the concept? This is clearly a metaphor, and it's clearly connected to the plame shot. Generally speaking, the Medrashim are expansions of the plame shot. They have to fit in. It's not completely separate. So, in order to understand this, the concept that they saw them belev echad, a certain type of a unity, ki ish echad, that's the plame shot that Rashi gives. Mitzrayim. They witnessed the entire nation with a certain sense of purpose and completely organized to achieve a certain objective. This, I would say, is a further expansion of that in a midrashic level, a metaphor. Perhaps the reason for saying "Vnei Yisrael Yotzim B'Yad Rama" at this point is to illustrate the change, that there was a change in attitude, that when they left with a certain confidence. And that was sustained at that point when they listened to Moshe, Vayasuchein. But as a result of what occurred here, they suffered a certain type of a regression, a setback. And we have to try and understand the nature of that setback, because it's very crucial. Now, the way it unfolds is that they saw a visual sight, which was the unified Egyptian nation, the army, everybody with a tremendous sense of purpose coming after them. Now, when Rashi says the Davar Achar, that is, that they saw the Sar Shel Mitzrayim, it's metaphorical. It means to say that this was the psychological effect of what they had seen visually. The two things are not disconnected. They're clearly connected. But this is extremely significant in providing us with an understanding of what takes place over here. And it's an introduction to the tremendous significance of the Kriyas Yamsuf and then the Shira that follows. The idea of Sar Shel Mitzrayim, I'm basing myself on a pshat that Rabbi Chait gave years ago. And I have tapes on the whole area of the Shira, the significance of the Shira. It's interesting. Both of us gave Shira on this topic, and I think the ideas are pretty similar. Although I didn't base myself on the idea of the Sar Shel Mitzrayim. But that is, I based myself on the idea, but it wasn't connected to the Pshat and Rashi. The Sar Shel Mitzrayim is very, very significant. It represents a certain type of a psychological phenomenon, which is the essence of an enslaved people. And that is the image that every dictator, every cruel system that tries to impose its might bases itself on a certain phenomenon. And that is the deification of the image of human power, the image of human might. And that's the whole battle of mankind in order to free itself from the overestimation of the human force, of human power. And because that becomes an obstacle to the recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's what causes the tremendous fear of people. And it's a main theme, major theme in the Tfilos, to break down this idea, to recognize that man is weak, that no matter how powerful he may appear, it's just a figment of your imagination. In reality, he's very, very weak. And the real cause of what occurs in this universe is the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I tied this in, for example, you see this phenomenon operative in Nazi Germany, that the Nazis tried to create this myth of the super race. And it's a very powerful psychological force, because the truth is that people bought into this. And when they were riding high, when they were at the peak of their power, so this myth itself was a major factor in intimidating the other nations, and they were able to take over other countries in matters of days because people were so frightened. And that was based upon the projection, that overestimation, that deification, investing the idea of human might with a certain type of a divine power. And to a certain extent, the Jews partook of this to a certain extent. That's how, one of the reasons why, even in the concentration camps, historians have pointed out that, relatively speaking, there weren't that many Germans there to control them. And had they made an uprising, in fact, in certain places they did, then they would have been able to perhaps overcome them. But they were able to rule with the sense of fear, intimidation, that they're a master race and there's nothing you can do against them. It's interesting that if you read the description of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, after they had pretty much decimated the Warsaw Ghetto, removed most of the Jews, so there was only a remnant left. Essentially, they were teenagers and young people, and they decided to fight. And they initiated a revolt. And you read the descriptions, they knew that it was hopeless, that they were going to die anyway, but they decided that they'd rather die fighting. And it's amazing the type of resistance that they put up. They held the German army at bay. They had to send in all kinds of reinforcements, and eventually they were just blowing up one building after another. The ferocity of the resistance. But when they describe it at first, what was amazing is that they sent in their tanks. The Germans thought it would be a cakewalk. It would be nothing. And the first fighters, they ran out and they opened up a tank and threw in a Molotov cocktail and blew up a tank. And they describe how the Germans were screaming in agony and torture, running away. When they saw that, it broke down the whole myth of German superiority, that they're humans like anyone else, and they saw them in a state of tremendous fear and screaming and horror, and this broke down the myth. And when that myth is broken down, it gave them a tremendous courage. So you see that this myth of human might and the deification of human power is a paralyzing thing. And this is a important element in trying to, in understanding what the significance of the Kriyas Yamsuf and the whole idea of Hashemish Milchama, that the ultimate power is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And to break down, that's why you see that when the Jewish army goes out to battle, so the Kohen has to read Psukim to them. It mentions that they'll come out against you with all these different devices and horses and making all kinds of noises and trying to intimidate you. And the methodology that we use to combat that is not to fall into the same mode of thinking. Right, Jay pointed it out, that every other nation seeks to oppose this type of thing by building up their own psyche. And basically, they're using the same method, but they're trying to apply it to themselves. To try and attach that emotion of superiority, of supremacy to themselves. And in Yahadus, we don't do that. We don't make use of that mechanism, which is false, but it's a recognition that the only reality is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that it's to break down the myth of human might. So what happened over here was that they looked up and they saw the Egyptian nation. And when they saw them in that position, arrayed, unified, organized, so it brought to mind the Sar Shel Mitzrayim. That's the myth, the image, that sense of unbeatable, being unbeatable. And that's what caused them to become paralyzed, to lose all of their courage. They had not yet been freed from that emotion, which is, I guess it's understandable. I mean, obviously, they had been enslaved to the Egyptians, and there's always that tendency of overestimation of the oppressor. But that's basically what takes place over here. This was now to create the stage. The Jews were in this state, and they were completely paralyzed to the extent that they couldn't, at this point in time, they really couldn't even do battle. Because another question that I raised when I took up the issue of the Shira, one of the questions was that in this case, you see that the Jews were not commanded to fight. That's also interesting. Because Moshe says, Hashem yilachim lachem. God will fight for you. V'atem tacharishun. And here too, Vayomer Moshe Elam, Moshe said to the people, Al tiro, don't be afraid. His yatzvu ra'u, as Yeshua Sarasham. Stand up and see, take note of the Yeshua Sarasham. That is to say, you're in this situation where on the one hand you're overcome by this emotion, this overestimation of the human. Yeah, fine. And then now watch and see the Yeshua Sarasham. That the real Yeshua, the real power is Hashem, and that that everything that you attribute to the Mitzrayim is just a figment of your imagination. And you have to free yourself from that emotion. What God will do, ki asher isam es Mitzrayim hayom, for as you see them today, lo sosifu narosam ad olam. That's it. They're finished. And that will show you that this is just a figment of your imagination. So, I mean, I raised the question, that we see it's at the end of Bishalach, basically the same parsha. It's just a short amount of time later. It's a matter of weeks, and the Jews are attacked by Amalek. And this time, Moshe tells Yoshua, "Bachar lachem anashim, to choose men and to fight a war against Amalek." So they were capable of fighting. All right, so we have to understand Moshe Rabbeinu, and he was Mispalo when they saw him being Mispalo, and they were encouraged, and so on and so forth. But at that point in time, they were able to fight. Here, they weren't able to fight. So what's the cause of this transformation? So it seems to me that this is a major factor. At this point in time, they still were under the sway. They were smitten by that emotion of the overestimation, the deification of human might. And that's what happened over here when they saw Mitzrayim chasing after them. It aroused that emotion, and when that emotion takes hold, then you're finished. You're paralyzed. And apparently the command to them was to, they didn't have to fight, Hashem yilachim lachem, but his yatzvu, to gain control over themselves to the extent that they can perceive the real meaning, not just the destruction of the Mitzrayim. Because if that's the case, so God could have destroyed the Mitzrayim, and there's no point in them seeing. It wasn't just to destroy the Mitzrayim, but they had an obligation too, that they should see the Yeshua Hashem. To see that, and to utilize that idea in order to uproot completely this falsification, this tendency in mankind. It's a tendency, it's a very powerful tendency. And it keeps repeating itself throughout history. Every time there's a new empire, there's a new force, there's a new power, everybody projects the same thing. And you see that even on a smaller plane, where it becomes really absurd, you know, with regard to sports heroes and figures and legends and greatness, and to try and, you know, always looking for this the Superman phenomenon, to project divine powers onto the human. That expresses itself in every area of the culture. Even though it's absurd, in with regard to individual sports heroes, legends, and teams, and things of that sort. People are always looking for something on which to project this emotion. So that's the pshat. That's what takes place over here. And in general, to just give a general orientation towards the question, we're not taking it up in specific cases. We see over here that there was a transformation, that the miracles that they had witnessed, the destruction of Mitzrayim, the plagues, and the complete transformation of their situation from the time that Moshe Rabbeinu had come. And at first there was a tremendous setback, and then in spite of that, the tremendous change and the complete destruction of the Mitzrayim, and the fact that they gave them all of their gold and silver, and they drove them out of the land, so to speak. All of this, all the miracles in and of themselves, do not transform a person. Witnessing the greatest miracles are not enough in and of itself. In the case, for example, the first case after the Kriyas Yamsuf, even after the destruction of the Mitzrayim, given what we've just discussed, and that this was the most powerful, most paralyzing emotion, and yet they went through the experience and they sang Shira. So one would have thought that, okay, so now we've resolved all questions, we've resolved all difficulties, and there shouldn't be any further problems, and yet we see that they went 3 days, and they didn't find water, and then they come to Mara. That's the incident before the Mon. And the waters were bitter, so they start complaining already. And that story should be studied. Perhaps we'll take that up next time. It's very, very significant. The whole idea over there that that God cured the waters, cured the bitter with the bitter, with the tree, which is bitter. It's a very important concept. And we'll have to continue. But the point I'd like to make, though, is you see that they went 3 days without water. And the Chazal say that that really is a reference to Torah. Of course, literally they didn't find water, but it means that they also were not osek in Torah. And the general idea is that any miracle that a person sees, no matter how persuasive it is, will not be effective in the long run unless a person incorporates it and works on his emotions and overcomes his emotions. And if a person does not overcome the emotions and redirect them, and on an ongoing basis, on a daily basis, on an ongoing basis, is connected to the world of truth and reality, then he's just basically living an emotionalistic life. Then the emotions will find an outlet, and they'll find an outlet. They'll find the problem. They'll find the complaint, and then whatever he saw will be forgotten. Now, it doesn't mean he'll forget it in the sense he won't remember it, but he'll distort that, the significance. That was a different situation, and that's what God wanted then. But now this can't be the correct situation. That is not a problem. We make a mistake because we just assume that if we saw these things, there's no way we could ever sin. That's really a result of the fact that we don't have true self-knowledge. That is no protection from sin. The witnessing of great miracles is not a protection from sin. The question is a person living on the emotionalistic level, or is he living on the level of truth, on the intellectual level? He's constantly involved in a state of battling the emotions and keeping them under control and living in accordance with the objective truth. That's the Melchemas HaChayim. And it's not a question, one cannot ask that question, as to how is it possible that they witnessed these miracles and then proceeded to complain. Because that has to do with something completely different. The purpose of the miracles were, as the Rambam says, that they were necessary at the time in order to effectuate certain means, certain objectives. Of course, a chacham can learn a tremendous amount from it, but it depends upon how the person decides to live his life. If he's living a life of chachma, so then of course all of these miracles are vital, but then it's not the miracles. Then it's because the miracles are just simply an avenue to direct them towards the source of Chachma, towards Torah. And the truth is that Torah is really based upon Sinai. It's not based upon the other miracles, it's based upon the ultimate demonstration. But even Sinai itself is not going to have any effect upon a person if he's not living a life of chachma. And on that basis, you can understand the deviations. To the extent that people are not perfected, then the emotions are going to search for an outlet, and they're going to find outlets, and they're going to be involved in complaining. They're always involved in the miraculous phenomena which God performed for the Bnei Yisrael did not free them from the obligation of fighting the Milchamas HaChayim.